We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
This is Multipolarity, charting the rise of the new multipolar world order. Coming up this week.
Like Germany hiding in the euro, China have long played the game of keeping their currency soft to juice their exports. But now, with the accelerator still jammed to the floor on US inflation, it seems that the powers in Beijing might be looking to devalue the renminbi even further. Everyone plays currency games, the trick is not to get caught, and the problem for China might be that they're on the brink of embarrassing their adversaries.
Meanwhile, what happens when a miracle becomes a conjuring trick? After 40 years of weaving economic magic, the South Koreans now have the world's lowest birth rate, and GDP slumping back toward developed economy norms. Are they about to become an early Eastern front runner of the social problems of the West? And can they afford that, given their tough geopolitical neighborhood?
Exorbitant privilege is what they call the US ability to print the global reserve currency. So what if that privilege was revoked? Plenty of apocalyptic fiction has been written about that moment, but this week we've done the modeling to put a number on the dent in US living standards.
But first,
you one way or another. There's a lot of rumors bouncing around financial markets about a potential devaluation of the yuan or the renminbi, the Chinese currency. And there's a lot to it, probably, but some of it, I think, is being spun in a slightly misleading way. The news reports tend to be about, I saw one on Reuters, for example, where it was Chinese businesses were hoarding dollars, basically, that they were earning, presumably by selling to the United States. And they were hoarding the dollars because they were anticipating a decline in the renminbi. And the way that this is being portrayed, to the extent that it is being portrayed in the media, is that China are actively moving to devalue their currency. Now, China may undertake a devaluation strategy of their currency, but it is not wholly in China's control. Right. So effectively, the data point, there's a few data points going around, but one data point is a chart, which I think we've quoted his work on the show before, Andre Steno Larsen, who's very good to follow on Twitter. He does very good data work. He's got a chart up going around Twitter at the moment that shows the US dollar Chinese renminbi spot rate. That's the market rate. And also the, it's called the CFATS fixed mid rate. And the CFATS fixed mid rate is something like an official exchange rate. The People's Bank of China puts it together themselves out of a kind of composite of other exchange rates in an attempt, I guess, to steer the currency in a way. I mean, it's a controlled currency in many ways. It's a fixed exchange rate, but it's become less fixed over time. And if you look at the time series on it, you'll see this. It's gone from like these very controlled moves to being slightly chaotic, but kind of moving around a kind of central anchoring point. And what that tells you is it's still controlled, but it's not really tightly controlled as it was. Anyway, when the spot rate moves away from the official central bank stated rate, Steno Larsen is making the claim that this signals an impending devaluation. And that makes a lot of sense. Effectively, the central bank rate is their attempt, I guess, to manage expectations. And if the spot rate starts to slip from those expectations, it means that the market is trying to move the currency while the central bank not fights it, but isn't comfortable in it going in that direction. So question is, why is this happening? Why is the central bank control over the renminbi US dollar pair slipping? Well, I think it's probably quite straightforward. Basically, the US has a substantially higher interest rate than China at the moment. The US federal funds rate is 5.5%, quite high by recent historical standards. And the Chinese interest rate is 3.45%. So there's more than a two-point spread between the two. That, of course, reflects the fact that the United States has an inflation problem, that it's having a hard time getting under control. China, meanwhile, has almost a deflation problem. Basically, prices aren't growing. I'm not as convinced that's a problem as some people think it is, but it's definitely they don't have an inflation problem. And even a 3.45% interest rate in a pretty much zero inflation situation is actually a very high interest rate. And what it signals to me is they're trying to maintain the value of the currency. So basically, what's happening here, I think, in recent weeks is that, as we've been saying on the show multiple times, it's far less likely that the Federal Reserve was actually going to lower interest rates for the election because of various geopolitical events, inflationary shocks, and so on. And we've been saying that, and I think we've been proved right. The Fed is now largely backtracking on interest rate declines in the near future, and that's because inflation is sticking around. We've covered this on the show before. Well, that means that the markets are now saying, looks like this 5.5% might be sticking around for a while, and we don't expect the People's Bank of China to move the 3.45% interest rate that they have any further up. In fact, if anything, they'd be moving to cut it, and therefore the Chinese will eventually devalue. Now, the politics of this are going to be really, really interesting because ultimately China can kind of lean into this, and maybe we can talk more about it in a moment. China can lean into this devaluation because they're pursuing this aggressive export strategy that we've discussed on the podcast quite a bit. And of course, if the renminbi falls, all of their exports become cheaper for other countries. So it should actually turbocharge their exports. Now, normally, and I think this time as well, the United States and the West, if China end up devaluing the yuan, will end up saying, you're devaluing the yuan to try and steal market share. They may be doing that. But it would be wrong not to see that there is actually pressure building on the yuan right now due to interest rate and inflation dynamics in the world as a whole. And in fact, you can kind of make a case that if this devaluation happens, it's actually not so much a signal that China are trying to goose the system. It's more so a reflection of the fact that the US, not so much the West anymore, but definitely the US, has an inflation problem. And an inflation problem, almost by definition, is a competitiveness problem. And what their inflation problem is twofold, that it's obviously raising the domestic price of US manufacturers because there's inbuilt inflation in the system. But it's also putting upward pressure on interest rates, which is leading to an overly strong dollar relative to other currencies, which again feeds into the competitiveness problem. So if you look at it from a global point of view, interest rates are starting to actually really hurt the US, I would say. That will be my main takeaway from this. And China, yes, probably will end up devaluing this unless there's some change in current market conditions and so on. It'll probably be a very controversial political move. But the honest evaluation of it, in my opinion, is that this is mainly driven by interest rates and not so much by Chinese government policy. Although I do think they'll end up leaning into this and using it as an excuse to boost their export competitiveness.
I have two questions about this, and I'm not sure I would understand China devaluing or allowing the yuan to depreciate on two counts. The first is they already have a fairly hefty trade surplus. I know their current account surplus is lower than it has been in the past. I tried to look up some figures, and it was, you know, about 1.5% of GDP, but anyway, China has had a long-standing, it's a kind of chronic current account surplus, which is not a sign, from what I can tell, of a undervalued or an overvalued currency. Quite the opposite. You would kind of argue that if they have a chronic and a kind of ongoing current account surplus, then really it's a kind of prima facie evidence that the currency is kind of undervalued, not overvalued, and therefore it could kind of appreciate in value rather than depreciate. The other question I would have is the response of the rest of the world to any kind of Chinese devaluation. But let's go on the first one at first. Like, you know, the Chinese capital account is closed, right? So the renminbi doesn't, or the yuan doesn't, float freely in the same way that the British pound, or the US dollar, or the euro, or the anything like that floats, essentially. So what I'm trying to understand with regard to this is how exactly can you say that the Chinese currency is overvalued and therefore needs to depreciate when it's got a hefty trade surplus, essentially.
Yeah, so I think this is a kind of a common misconception. It's not really a misunderstanding, because what you're saying is actually, in a sense, correct. But it's a slight misunderstanding of kind of the post-Bretton Woods system, I'd say, or the post, you know, initial Bretton Woods gold dollar-based system. Currencies should, in theory, in very kind of grand theory, adjust to eliminate trade imbalances. And if you have a fixed exchange rate, gold-backed, dollar-backed, whatever, that will tend to happen. The system will tend to force those things to change. But since 1973, obviously, we've had very imbalanced trade. That's not a moral judgment, it's not a political, it's just a fact, right? Now, why is that? Why is it that in a world where you don't have, for example, the Bretton Woods exchange rate or the sterling gold standard prior to that, why is it that you get these current account imbalances? Well, it's because once you enter that world of free capital flows and floating exchange rates, or most exchange rates floating and some being pegged like China, what happens is the trade imbalances stop setting the value of the currency, or phrased differently, currencies stop moving to eliminate trade imbalances. Now, that's not always the case. If you get a really egregious trade imbalance in Turkey or Indonesia in the Asian Tigers crisis, eventually the market will probably close that. But if you can attract substantial amounts of capital on an ongoing basis into your economy, you can prop up a trade imbalance ad infinitum. Well, not quite ad infinitum, but I'll get back to that. So that's what we have. We have, for example, the US or the United Kingdom run massive persistent trade deficits and have for almost half a century, often growing, although obviously the US has come down from its peak. The UK grows and grows every year, almost. And the reason for that is because capital inflows are willing to finance that trade deficit. Those are effectively free movements of capital for the most part. You can also use government aid to do that, but doesn't usually happen for the United States or the United Kingdom. Free movements of capital come into the country and allow those trade deficits to be propped up. Okay? Now, in that scenario, in a scenario where you're running a trade deficit with a country. Okay, so let's take a tangible example. The United States runs a large trade deficit with China. China then basically has to, China or another country, has to basically send capital to plug that gap. So the Chinese capital has to flow into America, into American stocks, bonds, FDI sometimes, maybe even real estate. It has to flow in and counterbalance that flow. If it doesn't do that, the normal adjustment process will happen. Okay, so that's the world we live in, for the most part. Not in every country, but in many country pairs, and therefore currency pairs. In that scenario, the main driver of the value of that currency will be what's called carry in financial markets, which means interest rate differential. This is what I was getting at the very beginning when I was summarizing it. That's the difference between the US interest rate and the Chinese. As I said, it's 5.5 in the US, 3.45 in China. That discourages the capital flows, it encourages the capital flows into the US, if you see what I mean. It turbocharges the capital flows into the US because the Chinese capital, or it doesn't, I know there's a closed system in China, it doesn't even have to be Chinese, it can be from elsewhere, it can be from third parties or so on. That flows into the higher yielding assets. So let's say European capital is flowing into the higher yielding assets in the United States, and it's not therefore flowing into the lower yielding assets in China. And that's what determines that currency pair's value. So then the final thing I'd say on it is, in the long term, you're probably correct. Ultimately, a trade imbalance will probably be stamped out by the forces of history. But that will require that these capital flows dry up. And that is a very contingent issue. I mean, that's often what we talk about de-dollarization and so on. And in the case of Britain, that would mean that, you know, the City of London loses its prominence and so on. And yeah, that's the old Keynes phrase, in the long run, we're all dead. And in this case, in the long run, trade deficits and surpluses are probably dead. But we really don't know how long the long run is. I mean, the de-dollarization long run might be 2 years. It might be 10 years. It might be 30 years. It might go on for another 100 years if something changes. Britain's timeline probably is a lot shorter than that, but in theory, it could be longer. So, you know, in summary, if we're in this world where we have open capital accounts or partly open capital accounts like in China, and we have trade imbalances, at that point, financial markets move currency values. And the biggest determinant of that in most currency pairs is interest rate differential, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of does. I suppose, you know, it's one of those questions of where you start looking at it. Or you know, it's difficult to understand because there are lots of moving parts. And sometimes it's easier to look at when you make one of the parts stop and use that as the basis for your view. Kind of another way of looking at it would be to say, and perhaps the wrong way of looking at it, you'll tell me in a second that it is wrong, I'm sure. But another way to look at it is to say, you're quite right to say that a trade or a current account deficit must be funded, right? Like you can't just, you know, a lot of people made this foolish mistake with the, you know, like the Russian sanctions, like a current account deficit must be funded. If funding doesn't go, then, you know, if funding doesn't go from country B to country A, then country A cannot run a trade / current account deficit. They just can't do it. It has to be funded in that kind of bilateral trading kind of model, if you like. So would another way to look at it, though, not be this, that China is essentially saving too much, and that money has to go somewhere, and it's going into the US markets. And by doing that, it's holding down the yuan, the renminbi, and it is allowing China to export more than it should, i.e. it's allowing China to rely on external demand, like US demand, essentially, for its goods. China is producing too much. This is sounding very Janet Yellen, I know, but China is producing too much for China itself to consume. So it's also producing stuff for the rest of the world to consume. And that's not an ideal kind of trading system, because ordinarily that excess Chinese production in like battery electric vehicles or in, you know, 22 nanometer chips or in like stuff that goes to Walmart. I'm not sure how much of that they produce anymore, or how much of the economic model's built on that. But just as an example, the money that they made from that would be recycled into stuff that they bought from other countries in return. And it's not being. That's why they've got a trade surplus every single year. So would another way to look at it not be to say, no, how you explained it is kind of back to front. Actually, what's happening is China is saving too much. They're engaging in financial repression. And that money is going to the US. And obviously, the US as a kind of an accounting necessity is inevitably going to end up buying stuff from China with that money. It kind of flipping the narrative around there. And therefore, the Chinese yuan needs to appreciate, to increase in value, to essentially balance those trade out, you know, flows, essentially.
This is kind of what I call a moral case or a political case. And I don't mean to be like flippant about that, because like, I agree with what you're saying that like, I don't think trade imbalances should be there. I think that's a problem. In terms of the causality, I mean, we don't have to go too far into it because it doesn't make that much of a difference to the argument. But I don't think this oversaving argument is true. I think it's very clear that what drove the trade imbalances in the world was globalization and manufacturing leaving the United States to go to China. And the reason for that was the Americans let low-wage Chinese competitiveness take advantage and steal their manufacturing base. I think basically the Trump populist line is the correct interpretation, and the savings dynamics that come in afterwards are residual, as we'd say in economics. By the way, that is the Keynesian view. This oversavings view is what we call neoclassical view in economics. And Trump is an intuitive international payments Keynesian, which is kind of funny because he's on the Republican side. That doesn't really make that much of a difference, though, because no matter what you think caused it, whether it's oversaving or whether it's low-wage competitiveness grabbing manufacturing, it doesn't ultimately matter because the world is the way the world is. It's the way the world is for a variety of different decisions made by a variety of different players. Now, the neoclassical will say that's the decisions of the Chinese saver, you know, the little Chinese old lady saving away under a mattress. They'll blame the Chinese old lady. Seems absurd to me, but fine. the more kind of Keynesian would say, well, World Trade Organization, entering the World Trade Organization, ignoring these imbalances blowing up, not even fully blaming China, because prior to China doing this trade imbalance thing with America, America used to do it with Japan. So there seems to just be this kind of instinct to wreck your manufacturing and send it to other countries. Whatever. Anyway, the world is the way it is. Either it's bad policy-making decisions or it's due to little old ladies in Japan and now in China saving their money. You decide. I know which one I find more credible. I know which one I think the data fits. Doesn't really matter. Whatever is driving that, the world is the way it is. And someone created this system, or some people working together, various countries working together, created this system. The system is what it is because we don't have fixed exchange rates. We don't have the Bretton Woods system to solve these problems. We made that decision. The United States made that decision in 1971 and then finalized it in 1973 with the closing of the gold window. And we entered into the world we entered into. And as I just pointed out, China may be the guy who's running the trade surplus now, but it was Japan. In fact, Japan's still running a massive trade surplus with America, so that's still going on. So this has been a long time coming. Germany did in the 80s, I think, as well, with the US, or maybe the 70s. So look, the world is the way it is. Now, here's what I'm saying. In this world where we can blame the little old lady or we can blame poor policymakers or whatever, the trade imbalances are there. And they are driven by deep structural forces, whether it's the little old lady or whether it's the decisions made to ruin manufacturing and send it abroad. Either one of those, trade deficits are there. And the financial system is allowing those, this is what I said at the start, the financial system is allowing those trade deficits to exist. You agree with me on that? So then it becomes a question of policy levers in that world. And there are there are a couple of policy levers. We won't get into them all, but two of them are related. Revaluation and devaluation of your currency and interest rate management. Interest rate management acts on the currency, or you can act on the currency directly by selling printed currency of your own into the foreign exchange markets, or by buying your currency using your reserve holdings. So that's the world we're in. Those are the levers. There's a couple more levers, reindustrialization, industrial policy, tariffs. We won't go into them. But those are the levers available. And effectively, if you were the Chinese and you were about to devalue, what you would say, and I don't think you're being disingenuous about this, you would say, we are devaluing because the United States has far too high interest rates for our economy. We can't raise interest rates in China any higher or else our economy will go to the wall. It's not suitable for our current growth trajectory. And United States, if you're so concerned about us devaluing our currency, you need to lower your interest rates because we can't do anything otherwise. And the United States will say, well, we don't want to lower our interest rates because we're trying to get inflation under control. To which the Chinese will respond, that's a you problem, not a me problem. Now, the Americans could conceivably turn around and say what they said to the Japanese in the mid-1980s in the Plaza Accords and say, well, we'd like you to readjust your currency. Why don't you spend some of your US dollar reserves to buy more yuan and keep it propped up? And maybe we'll help with that. Maybe we could introduce swap lines or something like that. And we'll have a joint program like the Plaza Accords to make sure that the renminbi stays where it is. That is a possibility, but it's not happening. And why is it not happening? Because Joe Biden's decided to go to economic war with China. That's why. And they can't sit down with the Chinese and sound out an idea like the Plaza Accords right now. The Chinese might even accept that. I don't think they're chomping at the bit to devalue the yuan. They're clearly trying to maintain it, and the spot rate is slipping. That's what I explained. So actually what we're seeing, if I'm correct, is another instance of Biden's stupid economic war on a more economically powerful country coming to bite America in the behind. Because the one option on the table here to sit down, send your trade guys and economist guys and Janet Yellen doesn't go over there to give them lectures on their competitiveness or whatever clown activity she got up to over there. She sits down at a table and she goes, we're worried about a yuan devaluation. And the Chinese people go, we're probably not as worried, but, you know, we wouldn't mind just keeping the yuan where it is. And then you hammer out a Plaza Accords. That might be possible. But you've got such incompetence in charge of this economic management now at the Treasury and so on that it can't be done. And the politics aren't there for it either, because Joe Biden wanted to go around and call Xi Jinping a dictator. So this is just more Biden destruction, Biden self-destruction, the usual, the thing we cover on the show all the time, that this administration is just, it hasn't got a game plan and things just keep coming back and biting them. And then they have to ramp up the rhetoric more and say, China, you just devalued your currency to sell your EVs. And that's what they'll do. And then they'll raise tariffs more and make American manufacturing even less competitive. It's all really self-destructive.
Yeah, well, speaking of the political side of things, I have two questions about that. My instinct is that the Americans will go apoplectic. They'll be incandescent if the Chinese devalue their currency, because it's going to make even worse the trade imbalances between the two countries. It's the thing, you know. Yellen has just gone to Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary and the former chair of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank, has just gone to China to say, look, you're producing too much. You're flooding the market with stuff that we can't compete against. If China then, not in response to that, of course, but, you know, a few months after that, whacks their currency down and therefore makes their manufactured goods even more competitive, then the Americans are going to hit the roof, surely. And actually, I wonder whether other countries will hit the roof as well, like South Korea, like Japan, and maybe even some of the developing world as well, and some of China's neighbors. They might say, whoa, hang on a second. Like Vietnam, for example, might just say, like, might end up having to devalue themselves for the same thing to maintain some kind of competitiveness, because, you know, the Chinese are already eating everyone's lunch on manufacturing. If suddenly those manufactured goods become cheaper versus the rest of the world, it's going to be, you know, a nightmare for anybody with any aspirations of manufacturing anything. However, I also wonder whether the Biden administration might not be maybe okay with it in the short run, because it would essentially export deflation, wouldn't it? It would make Chinese goods cheaper. You'd be able to buy more Chinese goods with your dollar. And what does that mean? Well, that means inflation would be helped, probably, in the US, I would have thought.
All true. On the Biden thing, you're assuming way too much competence. I'm sorry. Like, I've been watching these guys for 4 years now. They're stupid. Like, they don't have a game plan. I'm not saying they're all stupid. I'm sure there's some smart economists in the Biden administration, but they're not showing their...
I think the word you're looking for is adults in the room.
Yeah, the adults have definitely left the room a long time ago. Like, yeah, you could go and make the deflation case for Biden's election, but they won't think of that. They just see everything in terms of fights now. It's ridiculous. It's what I was saying about the Plaza Accords. Could Yellen go over to China and say, we want to hammer out a Plaza Accord over this? Yeah, if there was better political will, if she had that idea in her head rather than going over and lecturing people, which is all she seems to do as far as I can tell. Like, there's no strategy. There's no grand strategy, economic strategy that I can see in DC. So I'd say that to that. In terms of the rest of the world, I think the countries that are currently soaking up Chinese exports in order to develop rapidly, these are the kind of global south, as we call them, the ASEAN nations and the other BRICS nations. I think they're happy as Larry. If you're a Russian and you have 10% knocked off the price of a Chinese car, are you really sad? I don't think so. Your trade balance is pretty good with your energy and so on. I think that'll hold for a lot of them, because they're using that imported Chinese stuff to kind of, you know, turbocharge their growth and stuff. So I think they'll be okay with that. In terms of an economy like Vietnam or South Korea might be a good example too, where they're kind of actually competing with this Chinese stuff. And they turn around to the Chinese and they go, oh, you just devalued. Well, first of all, the Chinese can reasonably sit across the table from them, and assuming that they have literate economists, they can explain the interest rate differential. And those economists will go, yeah, I suppose I kind of see your point, and they'll brief their government on that. But beyond that, they'll also just say to them, of what you just said, you're perfectly free to devalue your currency, Vietnam. You're perfectly free to devalue your currency, South Korea. You print Vietnamese, are they dollars or North or South Korean won? You print it up and you sell it into the market. It's not hard. You can lower your interest rates too, but if you don't want to do that, print and spend. And you know what they can also say? They can say the same thing to America. America, you're perfectly free to print up dollars at the Federal Reserve and sell them into the foreign exchange market. And the Americans go, we don't do that. We don't manipulate the dollar. Okay, well, that's your problem. And so that's the issue here. That actually what's happening is, in my opinion, the Biden administration doesn't have a coherent economic vision, coherent economic game plan. It's starting to see all economic policy as some sort of war where you punch the guy in the face and he punches you in the face. And it's ridiculous and it's self-destructive. And so they're just not going to be able to. I'd be very, very surprised if the Biden administration comes along and competently handles this problem, either by sitting down and discussing the issue, or by having a debate about interest rates and inflation, or by saying, will we just intervene in the dollar foreign exchange market, which we're perfectly free to do. My bet is you won't see any of that. You'll see more rhetoric. You'll see more old man shouts a cloud. And maybe Yellen will do another lecture trip over where she tells people who are probably kind of smarter than her what they should be doing with the economy while her own economy is an inflationary mess. Korea advice.
There was a big think piece in the Financial Times this week, or recently anyway, which asked whether South Korea's economic miracle was over. Many of our listeners will be aware that South Korea has been a poster boy for emergence from developing economy status to developed economy. It was one of the few countries that managed to escape the middle income trap. And after Japan was one of the first Asian tigers, it really had very stellar economic growth. And then it appeared to move up the value chain and now produces loads of really cool stuff that we all love. It produces Samsung phones and LG TVs and very reasonably priced high quality cars from Kia and Hyundai. And even culturally, South Korea has started to do very well. South Korean food is becoming increasingly popular. Who doesn't love a Korean barbecue? South Korean pop culture, South Korean music, K-pop, for those of us of that persuasion. Not me, unfortunately. It kind of loses me a little bit. But economically, they might not be doing quite so well. In the Financial Times article, they highlighted that from 1970 to 2022, GDP in South Korea grew at an average of 6.4%, which is stellar growth by anybody's measurements, I would say. It's kind of German economic miracle levels. It's even, you know, China emerging from Deng's reforms. It's those sorts of levels. But the Bank of Korea warned last year that annual growth is on course to slow to an average of only 2.1% in the 2020s, 0.6% in the 2030s, and then even shrink by 0.1% a year in the 2040s. The Financial Times article suggests several things. It, of course, mentions the demographic crisis. I mean, the working age population, I believe it's already declining. They have one of the worst total fertility rates in the world. It's way below replacement level. I believe I'm right in saying that the working age population will shrink by 35% by 2050. So there's a demographic issue. There's also one economist said, I was quite surprised at this, that South Korea has a weakness in developing underlying technologies. It is fantastic, apparently, at taking new technologies and making them applicable to making stuff, like to manufacturing and manufacturing processes. Superb at that, but less good at developing the underlying technologies. I was surprised at that because South Korea is a poster boy for the amount it spends on research and development as a percentage of GDP. It's like something like 4.2%. It's up there with Israel. It's about twice that of the UK. But perhaps that's all translational research, translating new developments to manufacturing rather than doing the new development themselves. They also mentioned in the Financial Times story that maybe the economic model is losing ground. Their kind of state-directed capitalism where manufacturing really does get a lot of lift from the state, even including very cheap energy, for example. The state also focuses on helping those big conglomerates, the chaebols, these huge companies with multiple big subsidiaries, for example. So maybe that's falling down, and their failure to develop more of a consumer market. So these were the reasons, Philip. You're the economist. What do you have to say, sir?
Yeah, I think the main thing I'd highlight, I mean, partly because it's a bit of a bugbear of mine, but, you know, I actually think it's true in this regard, is what you said, the birth rate. South Korean demographics are so bad. I mean, they're the worst in the world. The Japanese are ahead of them in terms of stagnation. That's a different story. That's because Japan have had low for longer in a way. But as you say, South Korea just seemed to have this bottomless pit of fertility rates. 2021 numbers that you get, if you Google them, are like 0.8 or something. But I think I saw something recently that they're down below 0.7. I think they're like 0.65. I mean, it must be weird to have birth rates that low. It is shockingly low. The other thing is they've been that way for a very long time. So last time they had a above replacement rate fertility, I think, was in 1982. So we've had 40 years of this. And they've been, you know, I'd say up until the mid-2000s, they were like tolerably bad, like they were above one. But they've had like nearly 15 years of like insanely bad demographics. And I looked at the data, and basically in about 2017, the South Korean labor market started shrinking. So I think that's probably the core driver. I know you have some ideas on China and competitiveness, and I want to ask you about those in a minute. But the one that stands out most for me from a purely kind of like macroeconomic modeling point of view is their demographics. Because at the end of the day, GDP growth can be easily divided into working age population growth, that's growth in the labor force, plus productivity growth. What you might speak to about competitiveness is productivity growth in a sense. I mean, it's not quite, but it sort of is. And working age population growth is just demographics. And it's quite clear their working age population has been contracting for 7 years now. So now we're starting to see the effects of that. And it's killing the movement. The question is, I think, the broader question, because we're all going through a demographics crisis, the whole West is, the whole world really is, in a sense, better or worse places for it, is why is the South Korean one so low? So I'll just give two kind of brief arguments on that, because I'm kind of involved in the demographic debate, especially in Britain. One argument for it is South Korea has developed a very peculiar dating and relationships culture, I suppose, family structure culture. A lot of people cite the 4Bs movement or 4B movement. It's a radical feminist movement. Those are great, which started in 2019. I'll just tell you what the 4Bs are. By the way, Bs are no's, so like no to. So there's no sex with man, that's bisexy, no child rearing, that's bichulzan, I'm probably not pronouncing this right, no dating men, that's bionne, and no marriage with men, that's bihon. That is a pretty weird thing to go mainstream. It can probably be explained by the fact that in Western society, the feminists will kind of... I mean, I don't want to be mean about it, but, you know, you can picture a kind of radical feminist in your head and the kind of a funny style of dress and so on.
We are going down a very dicey path here, Philip Pilkington. Be careful. You're taking your life into your hands and ours as well. So
make no moral judgment. But, you know, in South Korea, they have this very traditional family structure still in place. Feminists would call it patriarchal. And it's probably true. There's probably some truth to that. And so the way that feminism seems to be manifesting in South Korea is in this, I would say, a way that could prove more socially destructive, because it could convince more people to not have families, basically. Okay, the other explanation, which I think probably both of them have something to them, is that all Western countries, due to something inherent in them, is falling to South Korean level birth rates anyway. And South Korea has a kind of a hyper-capitalist mode of development. They work a lot, they consume a lot. Anyone who's seen South Korea, they know what I mean about this. And that they're just further ahead of the game than we are. It's kind of the like live in the pod, eat the bugs lifestyle kind of thing, you know, not conspiracy theory, but you know what I mean? Like live in an urban city, eat the takeout, don't think about, you know, having a family, just work for the corporation, go to brunch on the weekends. I think maybe they've got that faster than we have. But then again, maybe that's where the 4B movement comes from as well. So I'll just say finally, initial data from Britain does suggest that Zoomers, Generation Z, have unusually low birth rates, but the jury is still out on whether they're just delaying children or not. Anyway, sorry, you have an idea that it might be due to a competitiveness issue, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still recovering from the four Bs, the knowledge that Andrea Dworkin has made so much, has had so much success in South Korea. Yeah, as I was reading this, I actually started wondering whether one of the problems that South Korea faces, and, you know, you would have to really dig into the data on this, you would need to be a much, I mean, you would need to be any kind of expert on South Korean economics, let alone a really good one, to understand this. But as I was reading this, I suddenly thought that a lot of the things that China has done in the last 5 to 10 years, as they've moved up the manufacturing value chain, as they've gone from, you know, making their money from producing that kind of the cheap tat that you buy in Walmart or in Tesco or Asda, and they've moved up the value chain, and now they're making things like, you know, the best battery electric vehicles in the world and pretty good semiconductors and all the rest, you know, pretty high-end military stuff as well. It suddenly struck me that a lot of this stuff that China's doing now and doing very well and taking over the world in is actually exactly the kind of stuff that upon which South Korea has built its manufacturing miracle. It's shipbuilding, where China now dominates the world. But Daewoo, the Daewoo shipbuilding was huge in the 1980s. I grew up on Tyneside. I can remember South Korea shipyards starting to take over the world, you know? And I wonder whether China is now taking over from South Korea. It's that semiconductor market. It's not the kind of real bleeding edge stuff that are made in Taiwan, the kind of 3-nanometer chips. It's that kind of, you know, 9 or 22 nanometer range, where China is starting to produce a lot of those chips. And those are the sort of things that Samsung have traditionally produced. It's also things like mobile phones. You know, again, you've got Samsung, and in China, you've got Huawei. It's cars, it's Kia and Hyundai, but now here come the Chinese, and they're absolutely, you know, they're the biggest car exporter in the world at the moment, and it's looking like they will absolutely dominate the electric vehicle market. So I wonder whether, to a certain degree, China is just eating their lunch on all of these things. Maybe China, you know, China does plan their economy. They've got some pretty smart people. I wonder if they've looked at the South Koreans and gone, yeah, that's the way to do it. And we could do that. And guess what? We have a bigger internal market. We can throw more money at this because we have more money. We have a less expensive workforce, perhaps energy that's just as inexpensive, et cetera, et cetera. So we can do this and do it a bit better, essentially. And maybe that's happening. Here's a question, though, Philip. Maybe there's a solution for South Korea. And again, this is something that may be way out there, but maybe the solution for South Korea is actually to think, hang on a second, we've got a lot of economic synergies, like stuff that we do fits very well with the United States, our ally, okay? The US is trying to do all of this friendshoring and a fair bit of reshoring as well, but all of this friendshoring. They're our ally, they're our protector against the evil North Koreans. How about we try to put together a really great free trade deal that gives us access to the US market, but also in return, what we'll do is we'll maybe cut ourselves up from the Chinese market, and anyway, they're eating our lunch, so we're probably in the long run not too upset about that, even though we'll call it a concession. And we'll give the Americans the shipbuilding they need, because Americans really need shipbuilding at the moment. There's all kinds of trouble with the U.S. military. I know they won't want U.S. destroyers made in South Korean shipyards, and that's not going to happen. But things like merchant marine, which they need, transport ships, which they need, this could all be done in South Korea. The U.S. need microchips. The efforts to boost the chip manufacturing sector in the U.S. at the moment are going like at a snail's pace. In fact, Samsung has invested in the U.S., but things aren't going well there. So maybe the South Koreans can provide the U.S. With chips. They can provide them with cars. You know, the South Koreans make excellent automobiles. And they can provide them with things like, you know, like TV screens, monitors, washing machines, all of this sort of stuff. And by getting real preferential treatment, like barrier-free access to the U.S. market, and perhaps in return, being really good with the US in terms of the US trade war with China, for example, or guaranteeing the US, you know, like access in terms of ensuring security of supply and things like that. I'm not sure what you think about that. Maybe that's way out, but you know, if the South Koreans are going to ally with the US, if the US is going to go into this trade war and start strong arming its allies to join in the trade war, which it's doing, if the South Koreans are starting to run into issues with their economy, maybe getting access to the US would be great. And in return, by the way, one of the sectors that the Financial Times mentioned was underperforming were the capital markets in South Korea. So maybe getting Wall Street in there might be a boost to that. I don't know. I'm spitballing here, but those are my two thoughts on this. First, that the Chinese are eating their lunch on a range of key sectors for the South Koreans. And second, maybe they can solve it with a much tighter trade and diplomatic relationship with the US.
Yeah, I mean, on your first point, it kind of makes me wonder, ironically, of course, whether the 4B movement isn't a Chinese psyop. Unfortunately, I think it's more likely to be an American import, but who knows? To do that, I think there'd have to be a couple of difficult political moving parts. I think you are actually in part correct about this eating their lunch dynamic. I hadn't really thought about it. It makes a lot of sense. To replace the Chinese goods effectively in the US, presumably Korea would need an influx of labor. And that would have to be migrants. I doubt Americans would move there. So it would probably have to be from the surrounding areas. I don't know South Korea that well, but my sense is that doesn't go down well in the politics there. And then America, the politics around this would be interesting. I'd imagine if you decided to run for US president, which I know you've always dreamed of, Andrew, and you stood up on the balcony or on the pulpit or whatever, and you gave the perfectly rational argument that you just gave, you'd get pelted with tomatoes because American people want to bring everything back on shore. They're sick of trade deals. They don't like NAFTA anymore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the leadership level, this goes back to what we were saying in a previous segment, there is no plan. There is no plan in the Biden administration. And my fear is, even in the Trump administration, I'm hoping it'll be a lot better, will probably lack a very coherent plan on this front too. I wish the Americans would come up with a new trade plan. I wish they'd start talking about these issues at a very sophisticated level. That's why we do the podcast partly, but we're not even nearly there yet. So yeah, I mean, watch this space, but I'm not holding out much hope.
Dollar Save Club. We like to comment mostly on the news here at Multipolarity, but this week, one of our hosts, namely Philip Pilkington, published a fascinating report on industrial policy and reindustrialization and what it would involve. But one thing really caught my eye in this excellent report was he had a look at what the dollar and the dollar's status as global reserve currency, as international medium of exchange and trade, means for US living standards. Because I think I and many others have heard the phrase exorbitant privilege before, and how the US dollar's status as the global reserve currency affords Americans a much higher standard of living, allows the US government to run big deficits and all the rest. I'm a little bit more skeptical of those claims than other people, but it has always fascinated me, and I've never seen it quantified before. Well, here comes Philip Pilkington and his co-authors, and they made an effort to quantify what that exorbitant privilege would mean or means for US living standards and what it would mean if that exorbitant privilege disappeared, i.e. if the dollar ceased to be the global reserve currency, if it was knocked off its perch by something else. So Philip, why don't you tell us a little bit more about this report and give us some of the numbers? Because I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, well, I'll give some even better boosterism and then completely deflate the whole thing. First of all, there are no co-authors, so it's just me. But second of all, I arrived at the result completely by mistake. So unfortunately, this was not a genius flush of intuition. We were laying out in the paper the constraints on reindustrialization. I was doing basically simple econometric test to see, you know, if you could have a large manufacturing sector with high wages, for example, whether you needed FDI to encourage manufacturing investment, this sort of thing. And we were also testing certain things on the trade account, on the current account. And a really fascinating finding rolled out, actually, just without going too much into the details, I just think it's very funny. I ran it by the other people at the Hungarian Institute of International Affairs who published the paper. And the two people who went over the paper highlighted this graph and said, this is really interesting. And I said, yeah, it is kind of. So we gave it an appendix at the end. So this is kind of an accidental result. But I guess, you know, this often happens. So I was running basically a simple regression on current account balance as a percentage of GDP. So effectively kind of trade surplus, trade deficit, not quite, but, you know, you can use that as shorthand. An average daily income in dollars, as in like the average amount of dollars a person gets paid. So like $20 a day, $30 a day, $40 a day, $50 a day. And you get a very strong correlation between the two. Well, very strong for the variables that we're dealing with. Explaining current account balances or average daily income is not usually a simple process. So if you get a reasonably good regression fit on something like that, you should pay attention. Now, this makes sense. This isn't just completely plucked out of nowhere. Although I didn't come up with the idea to test this and it was ultimately a mistake or an accident, I was able to interpret it because there's a body of literature out there in economics called Balance of Payments Constrained Growth Models. I won't go too much into it, but it's very interesting literature. It's very well empirically supported, which is unusual for trade economics in particular. It kind of goes back to a guy called A.P. Thirlwall. And what it says basically is that you can only really grow an economy in line with export growth to a large extent, because if you run too large a trade imbalance, it'll readjust. I think we actually alluded to this earlier in the program. You can run trade imbalances, but past a certain point, it'll adjust. And that adjustment will usually mean slower growth, hence the constrained growth. So this does actually make sense. And it's an unusual way of showing it, I suppose, but it works. Anyway, what we found was basically that most countries fall along the regression line in some way. And that if you have a very bad current account deficit, you'll on average have pretty low living standards in a sense. You'll have pretty low average daily income. And the countries with the highest average daily income, the richest countries in the world, have very large current account surpluses. You can think in this regard of Luxembourg, Norway. But there's one country, and only one, that really falls off the regression line. It's what you call an outlier. And that's the United States. The United States have the highest living standards in the world, according to average daily income in US dollars. Now, that might be a misleading metric, but we could discuss that, but it's kind of boring. They are the richest country in the world on this metric, whether that metric is representative or not. Maybe it's not. But on this metric, they are. And this metric is very similar to per capita GDP, nominal per capita GDP, basically. And yet, their wealth level at $74.42 a day would usually be associated with a country that runs about a 6 to an 8%, if not more, trade surplus. Instead, the United States currently runs almost a 3% trade deficit. So what explains this? It's pretty obvious, actually. Remember, we're measuring this in daily income in dollars. It's the dollar's exorbitant privilege. It's the fact that it's a reserve currency. Translated differently, other countries have to adjust their living standards to live within their means in terms of trade. America doesn't at the same level. It just doesn't have to adjust that because they have this exorbitant privilege, which means that other countries are willing to accumulate paper dollars and not force the US to adjust their living standards in accordance with this. So to finish up, we did some modeling and we said, well, this allows us to say, at least in a crude form, we could probably do a more sophisticated one, but I probably won't bother. I think the crude form is reasonably okay. How much living standards would roughly adjust if the US dollar lost its exorbitant privilege? And I won't go into it because we got two results and I had to choose between them. But the more credible result that we got, that I thought we got, was that it would fall to about $52.14. That's daily income. That's from $74.42. And that's an adjustment of about 27% in US living standards. I think it's reasonable. I think it's intuitively reasonable. I ran this by a friend of mine who's not an economist, but he's thought about this a lot. He's a foreign policy guy. And I asked him before I sent it to him, guess how much? And he said 20 to 25%. We got 27. So it kind of fits with intuition, I think. But it should also be said, that's an absolutely enormous drop in living standards. And almost a third wiped it, or a little more than a quarter, okay, we won't be too generous. A little more than a quarter wiped off your living standards is brutal. Now, it wouldn't happen in 1 year. It'll happen presumably over a number of years, and it probably won't be in absolute terms. It'll probably be in relative terms. So if other countries continue to grow, et cetera, et cetera. But it would be a very, very painful readjustment for America. What would that mean intuitively? I don't know. I was actually talking to my friend that I just referred to there yesterday about it. And we were kind of like, would we be talking about bouncing half the middle class into the lower middle class? And I said, you know, that might not be a bad way to look at it. So this is really interesting. Obviously, dollar is not going to evaporate overnight, exorbitant privilege, but de-dollarization is taking place. We know that from kind of central bank gold accumulation. We know that from difficulties recently selling US government debt to foreign buyers. There's a whole host of issues that indicate de-dollarization is slowly but surely underway. Well, now we have an answer. Their living standards could fall by just over a quarter if this process of adjustment were to go ahead.
I might be talking nonsense here. I'm not an economist, Philip, but my intuition is that it wouldn't, if it happened, it wouldn't happen like over several years gradually. It would happen very suddenly. My feeling is that global trade balances are so out of whack and so intolerable. In some countries, you know, you have ever decreasing returns on investment because, you know, they're overinvested in their own economies and in their own production, and they need to shift the balance of their economies, you know, more toward internal consumption and increase their own living standards. In other countries, they are, you know, they're the opposite. They're, you know, they're having to run huge deficits because there's not enough production. You know, they're not producing enough to sell abroad. They're consuming more than they save. And my sense is that either for economic reasons, like, you know, something's going to snap with a debt crisis because, you know, both sides are having to run out huge amounts of debt to deal with their own problems. And so something will snap on the debt side, and that will cause a huge economic crisis that will lead to a kind of a violent rebalancing of global trade. Or on the political side, where it will just become politically unacceptable for this to continue going. It'll become politically unacceptable for manufacturing jobs to be sucked out of one place. And it'll probably become politically unacceptable to continue the financial repression in other places. And I think we're seeing that political stuff already in the United States. And the opportunity in that process for miscalculation, especially when one side sees the other as an existential geopolitical rival, the opportunity for miscalculation and rapid devolution into all-out degeneration, into all-out trade war, is actually far greater than is widely appreciated. And in that sense, you would also get a violent rebalancing of global trade. So these things would happen. You know, it's one of those, you know, how do you go bankrupt slowly then all at once? I think these things have an opportunity to happen far more quickly than a kind of gradual process. And it could be pretty violent. It could be like a really horrible recession. And then when everybody wakes up from it, they're 27% poorer and they're just locked into that line of development, right? That's how I think it could happen.
I'd just say very quickly, that's perfectly possible. And I think the two things to watch out for on that front, one of them you've highlighted, a real full-on trade war with China. Yeah, I think that would do it. And the second one, less certain. I think a full-on trade war would actually do it easily. The less certain one would be a really, really bad financial crisis where financial capital inflows just stopped. They just said, we're sick of holding these volatile assets. That would kind of look like what you said, the recession from which you never recover.